We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the RotoWire Prospect Podcast. I'm your host, James Anderson, and today's guest is my friend Matt Eddy, the executive editor of Baseball America, and got a fun episode for you today. It's honestly one of my least favorite times of the year to talk about specific prospects, just because the amount of excitement versus the amount of sample size we have is always just so far out of whack this time of year. And I'd been wanting to have an episode talking about minor league park factors for a while, and I actually kind of threw that out in a recent episode, and I got multiple people saying they wanted to hear that episode. And I could think of no one better than Matt to break it down with me, because Matt puts together the minor league park factors articles every year at Baseball America that I reference basically all year until the next one comes out. So great to have Matt with me today. Matt, how would you kind of say that Baseball America, or just yourself, I guess, calculate these park factors?
Yeah. Well, first of all, James, it's great to be here again. Yeah, the park factors that I create are, I would call them, very unsophisticated. They're simply a comparison of home results versus road results. Take all the runs scored and allowed in each park, and then compare that with the same figures on for road games. That gives you an idea of how much the home park inflates or deflates runs scored. And for this exercise, I prepared 2022 and plus 2023 data to give us a pretty good sample.
Yeah, it's a really cool spreadsheet you put together here. Unfortunately, won't be sharing it with the listeners, but I'm thinking this could be maybe an evergreen kind of a podcast episode, just because there's so many people that listen to the podcast that I know kind of keep their own prospect rankings, whether it's maybe they've got a site or they're on Twitter, or maybe they just kind of keep them, you know, for themselves and they reference other sets of prospect rankings. And you absolutely have to be aware of the minor league park factors. There are some very extreme ones kind of in both directions. What should people be kind of keeping in mind when they're using minor league park factors? Is there anything you want to throw out there?
Yeah, I think the overarching point I would make is that organizations in the East divisions tend to have more pitcher-friendly venues, and the West tends to be dramatically more hitter-friendly. So probably the biggest lesson from that is for the East clubs, even if the runs created by some of the prospects in those East Coast affiliates seem a little lower, like those runs are more valuable in the context of the leagues and parks in which they are compiled. So I think that's the big lesson, like, that I would take away from this. So, because if you look at it at the big level, these are the affiliate, these are the organizations that saw the most runs in their games for the past three seasons. Athletics, you know, they have Las Vegas, they have Midland. I believe they have Lansing also sees a lot of runs. Diamondbacks, Rockies, Padres, Dodgers, Angels, you know, all West organizations. At the other end of the spectrum, Tigers, Marlins, Blue Jays, Braves, Yankees, Mets. So that kind of gives you a feel for like the run environments the typical prospect is facing in those organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. Has anything made it kind of complicated to calculate or adjust these at all, like over the past few years, just with all the different kind of rules getting introduced? I know you were kind of debating whether 2021 should be involved. You settled on 2022 and 2023.
Yeah, the rules do throw a little wrench into the thing, but I do think we have greater stability in the minor leagues than we ever have had, or at least in my time of following the minors, because we'd have the uprooting effect of the affiliation shuffle every 2 years. You know, people were getting, organizations were getting out of the Cal League, getting out of the Midwest League, or finding new affiliates within those leagues. So that introduced a lot of chaos, but we've had a lot of stability since the 2021 season. I decided to exclude 21 just because there was no April data that year. We started in May, so I thought that was a truly apples to apples, and just gave organizations a grace period, a year to kind of figure out how they're going to handle prospect assignments.
Very good. So we're going to start at AAA. Kind of work our way down and just kind of talk about which parks are sort of the most extreme, which leagues are, you know, favorable for hitters, favorable for pitchers, et cetera. So at AAA, we've got the Pacific Coast League and the International League. You know, I think for anyone who knows anything about minor league park factors, the one thing they might know is that the PCL is a run scoring haven. But how do you think the PCL and the International League kind of compare, just generally? Like, is it just all PCL and then the International League, or are there some International League parks that kind of measure up to some of those PCL parks?
Yeah, in general, year in, year out, you're going to find the PCL is the highest scoring league in the minors. This is because of the parks. You know, they tend to be higher elevation, higher altitude, the ball tends to carry, there are more hits in play because the outfields tend to be a little larger. You know, it's essentially Coors Field spread over, you know, five or six parks, the same phenomenon. But it's also the fact that AAA players are more physically mature, they're selected for their ability to hit and hit for power, so that also skews it. And in fact, you'll see that the International League is fourth highest the past 2 years in terms of runs. So it's above the average. Whereas the PCL is, you know, two standard deviations above the average. The IL is solidly above, but sees its share of runs. Some parks in the International League do favor offense. Charlotte is the most notable. It's a beautiful new park they built 10 years ago. It's got a small footprint in the city. So that's why it tends to play hitter friendly. Some of the other IL parks of note, Omaha and St. Paul, have seen a lot of runs. You know, I don't know 100% why that is the case, but they tend to be more offensive than the standard IL park.
Yeah, definitely. And there is sort of a big four kind of in the data in terms of the PCL parks that are sort of the most Coors Field-esque. Albuquerque, El Paso, Las Vegas, and Reno. Obviously, Albuquerque, the Rockies affiliate, El Paso, the Padres affiliate. Las Vegas is where the Athletics AAA affiliate is, and then Reno for the Diamondbacks. Are those four parks just kind of the big four in general? Of all the minor leagues?
Yeah, I would say so. They're way up there. There's one notable team at AA, but those are the big four you're looking at. And even when those teams go on the road, they're tending to play in hitter-friendly parks because they're all PCL West. So that also keeps those levels very high on the road. The one exception, I know we'll probably get to it at AA, but it's Amarillo, which is also in Texas. But
so just given the way that you're calculating these, you know, I thought you might consider, well, what about the affiliates where maybe the AAA roster is always a bit better, like say Oklahoma City. Like, you might expect there to be better hitters generally on the Dodgers AAA affiliate than, say, the Athletics AAA affiliate. But then kind of conversely, you'd have better pitchers with the Dodgers affiliate generally than with the Athletics affiliate. So do you think any kind of noise based on the just talent that we generally see in some of these organizations compared to lesser organizations, do you think there's enough noise there where people should be factoring that into these numbers, or do you think it just kind of evens out?
That's difficult to tease out. That's the question I have never been able to answer. I think what you said is right on, though, that what the park gives to the offense, it takes away, so that it does tend to level out, especially over larger samples.
So when you're, when we're looking at these crazy high scoring parks at AAA, Albuquerque, you know, we got like Jordan Beck off to an impressive start. They've got some kind of, you know, Sean Bouchard, Hunter Goodman types. They got Drew Romo there. El Paso, kind of light on notable prospect talent because a lot of those guys made the big league roster, but Graham Pauly. And then on the pitching side, Randy Vasquez, like if you're looking at a Randy Vasquez blow up outing or something like that at home, just kind of keep in mind that he is pitching in one of the worst parks to pitch in the minors, Las Vegas. Same disclaimer for like Joey Estes. And then you got Tyler Soderstrom, Jordan Diaz, Max Muncy, all hanging out at Las Vegas. So you'd expect those guys, you know, even a player like Muncy, who might be younger than the average hitter in the league, you'd expect those guys to put up pretty solid counting stats. And then Reno, you know, Jordan Montgomery, obviously pitching there right now. His numbers are terrible, but got to factor in that he is basically pitching in a worse park, a significantly worse park than he will be when he's in the big leagues. And then they got Slade Ciccone there. I'm always keeping tabs on what Justin Martinez is doing. And then Jorge Barrosa, and of course Jordan Lawler when healthy. We'll have to deal with Reno. What are some of the parks at AAA that really suppress runs, especially kind of relative to those top PCL parks?
Yeah, the Braves organization in general, like they have Gwinnett at AAA sees the fewest runs per game of any park. But then surprisingly at 29 and 28 are Sugar Land and Sacramento, a couple of PCL teams, not located on the in the kind of the hitter friendly area so much as the deep Southwest, but it is interesting to see them at the bottom here. And Sacramento, obviously notable for the reported home of the Athletics for the next three seasons, it sees about the same number of runs per game as Oakland Coliseum has seen, and relative to other parks at the level also fares similarly as the Coliseum. So the, you know, if that trend holds, there shouldn't be too much of a difference in run environment for Athletics players next year.
Yeah, I mean, that part's complicated because the, you know, I think the fences and the, from remembering correctly, the fences in left and right are maybe shorter than the typical big league park in Sacramento. But that was like a question I just got a ton when that news broke. It was just kind of like, okay, is this a big bump for A's hitting prospects? Because everyone had been kind of in their mind thinking Las Vegas, and then it's Sacramento instead. So you're saying kind of not to really bump those guys up necessarily just yet due to the move to Sacramento.
I wouldn't go too nuts. I think the outfield dimensions are similar. It might be a little shorter down the lines, which is not surprising. Minor league parks tend to be smaller, but I think it should be pretty similar.
Yeah. So Sugarland and Sacramento, bottom three AAA run scoring environments. And then you obviously mentioned Gwinnett as the most pitcher friendly park at that level. Let's head to a quick message from our sponsors. When we come back, Matt and I are going to look at AA park factors, high A park factors. We'll take a look at single A. And I've got some bonus questions for Matt towards the end. Some dynasty startup or taking over an orphan dynasty roster, which Matt has done very successfully in a league we both play in. And then one hitting prospect that Matt has been kind of leading the charge on over the past year or so, who's off to a fantastic start this season. So keep it tuned here. So yeah, if you're watching on YouTube, if you could please give us a like and subscribe to the channel if you're not doing so already, that definitely helps us out now that we're just MLB on this YouTube channel, which is very cool. Very excited that we're giving our player notes to So Rare. That's a really cool partnership. And if you are a RotoWire subscriber and you want to converse with me on Discord, rotowire.com/chat, if you're not already signed up over there. Finally, baseball is back this MLB season. Knock it out of the park with Vivid Seats and score great tickets to the biggest games of the year. Every fastball, every home run, and every eye-popping play of your favorite team live and in person. Plus, with Vivid Seats rewards, you earn rewards with every single purchase. Just buy 10 tickets, then cash in your credit toward your free 11th ticket. Talk about an easy win. And here's a pro reward tip. When buying tickets for your whole group, split the bill and make progress towards your free 11th ticket even faster. From behind the dugout to the upper deck, Vivid Seats has great tickets for all the 2024 games that matter to you. Just visit vividseats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. See vividseats.com/rewards for terms and conditions. Do you ever think back to the golden days of fantasy football? You know, when it was all about the love of the game, the camaraderie, and yes, the bragging rights? Well, our friends at On Demand DFS are bringing those days back with their revolutionary app that's changing the game for fantasy fans everywhere. Gone are the days of confusing entry fees, playing against unknown masses, or juggling multiple apps to trash talk with your league mates. On Demand DFS is here to streamline your fantasy football experience, making it more about strategy, fun, and most importantly, the community. With on-demand DFS, you create a contest in seconds, invite your friends, and you're off to the races. No entry fees, no gimmicks, just pure fantasy football bliss. And here's the kicker. You're not limited to current season players. Imagine crafting your dream lineup from over 5,000 NFL legends and today's stars using real historical data to simulate the action. And for those who hate the wait, you'll love Turbo Mode. Contest wrap up in minutes, not hours, keeping the excitement going all week long. Download the On Demand DFS app now and get started with a 30-day free trial. Dive into a fantasy football experience that's rich in history, strategy, and most importantly, fun. It's time to create your legacy with the ultimate lineup of legends and live out your fantasy football dreams like never before.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Okay, Matt, we are back. We're talking double-A park factors now. And at the double-A level, we have 12 teams playing in the Eastern League, 10 teams playing in the Texas League, and 8 teams playing in the Southern League. So how do these three leagues compare? I would assume, based on the comment at the beginning, that maybe the Eastern League is the more pitcher-friendly of these three.
Yeah, but that is true. What surprised me was the extent to which that was true. Eastern League, since the reorganization in 2021, has about 4.7 runs per game. It's about a standard deviation below average, making it one of the more pitcher-friendly leagues, one of the most pitcher-friendly leagues, I should say. And if you look just at the way each parks play at AA, the Texas League dominates the top. Amarillo, Springfield, Northwest Arkansas, and the Eastern League is all over the bottom, with places like Harrisburg, Akron, Binghamton, Somerset. So the extent to which the Texas League sees runs and the Eastern League does not, I think that surprises me to some degree. I thought the three leagues used to be on more even footing.
Yeah. And the big, you know, the big thing just with regard to these three leagues from last year was the pre-tech ball in the Southern League. And I don't think we've got anything like that in play this year, right? That's going to skew the strikeouts or walks.
No, not to my knowledge, no.
Yeah, so, yeah, again, 12 Eastern League teams, 10 Texas League teams, 8 Southern League teams. You mentioned Amarillo, where the Diamondbacks AA affiliate is, as the kind of clear, most hitter-friendly park at AA. And in fact, just in terms of runs per game, second only to Albuquerque, if I'm reading this correctly on the sheet. So Amarillo, definitely a park that you got to keep in mind when you're evaluating the performance of the hitters and the pitchers. You know, I mean, if there's a pitcher on the Amarillo roster, I think I'd be tempted to kind of just sort for their away stat or away splits if I could. I know that this kind of came up when Corbin Carroll was a prospect. There were people that were, you know, kind of skeptical of his power potential, that were kind of pointing to Amarillo as a potential reason why he was getting to power that might not be there in the big leagues. Has Amarillo, in your recollection, has Amarillo always been just kind of this double A park that's different from the others?
Yeah, it's always played this way. It's just a function of its elevation and just how the ball travels. You bring up a good point with Carroll, is that you don't want to be too punitive with these on the elite talents, because what they do will tend to play anywhere, their ability to hit for power. So that is a good point to raise, to not factor it so heavily for elite players. I think Jordan Lawler would fit in that group as well, if you're looking for future test cases.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's sort of the pop-up guys almost more so, or maybe the older guys that might, I'll reference that maybe with an affiliate at High A, but like one, I think I remember like Dylan Cousins, like when he was at Reading, I remember that being one where it was just kind of like, you know, how much should we buy in on this? But yeah, I think with Corbin Carroll, and really all these guys, like they're going to have to play in some of these parks. You know, it's not like Corbin Carroll can choose to just play in neutral parks on his march to the majors. So I think you just kind of have to trust the evaluation before they get to that level, right? Like you don't want to necessarily just fully buy into a guy who's only breaking out for the first time at a extreme environment.
Yeah, you got to trust the tools. Like if we're looking at six hit, six power, you know, that's going to work regardless of venue.
So what are some of the other, we've talked about Amarillo. I think actually Ryan Bliss was a guy I downgraded relative to like the surface stats he was putting up just because of his age and where he was doing it. So that's kind of the caliber of prospect we're talking about, maybe downgrading a little bit. So what other parks besides Amarillo are very favorable for hitters at AA?
Springfield, the Cardinals affiliate, has a pretty lengthy reputation of being pretty hitter and power friendly. Northwest Arkansas shows up on here. In the Southern League, Birmingham is the tops, but it's not a dramatic offensive park. I think we're, and then to round it out, Midland and Wichita are also way up here at Double A, also Texas League clubs. It kind of gives you a sense for the how the ball carries better in the Texas League relative to these other ones.
Yeah, so Northwest Arkansas, the Royals, Double A affiliate, Birmingham, White Sox, obviously Midland, Oakland. What about on the pitcher friendly side of things here at Double A? I know there's one at the very bottom that gets talked about a decent amount in the Southern League.
Is that Arkansas?
Mississippi,
yeah. Yeah, that one, ever since it opened, you know, the Braves have the monopoly on pitcher friendly at Double A and Triple A because they're in Rome, also at High A. I was, you know, Arkansas is interesting because the Mariners are affiliated with Arkansas, and they tend to skip their top pitching prospects right over Tacoma at Triple A and get them right to the majors from Arkansas. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. You know, Gilbert, Kirby, Bryce Miller, I believe, none of them really saw any Tacoma time on their way up. And I think that speaks to what we're talking about here with the way the parks play. And I think we might see more teams begin to do this in the PCL side. I think the AAA pitching prospect is becoming increasingly rare.
Yeah, it is. And that was another thing I was considering when looking at the AAA data of the run scoring. Like, you've got all these, you know, 25, 26 year old, you know, beefy quad A type guys who are just there to put up runs. And then you've got teams really kind of, you know, protecting their prized pitchers from that level oftentimes. So yeah, it is kind of like the perfect storm for run scoring at AAA, especially if more teams kind of follow what the Mariners are doing here. You know, like Logan Evans getting assigned directly to Double A. He hasn't been, you know, dominant or anything like that. He's got 4 strikeouts and 5 walks. But just whenever Seattle thinks a guy's ready for Double A on the pitching side, it's noteworthy because they could just be one step away. And yeah, I guess it's interesting because they've had so much success with the guys you listed. It's not clear probably whether it's because of just how talented those pitchers were or whether skipping them over AAA had any impact on their development. But it's kind of a copycat league in many ways. So is that kind of because it's not like this is what the Diamondbacks always do with their pitching. I mean, they're not going to jump them over Amarillo and Reno, but you know, it's not like this is what the teams with the crazy parks always do. This is a team with Tacoma doing this.
I know. And not to mention, it's the proximity to Seattle. It's very notable in that regard, because it seems like it would be easier, you know, to make a call up if you needed them from Tacoma and Arkansas across the country. I agree. It's definitely something that we'll probably see more organizations do on the PCL side in particular.
So, yeah, I guess Mississippi was at the bottom, I guess, for most pitcher friendly. Then you got Harrisburg and Arkansas, as we discussed there. Akron, that's a noteworthy one because they're, you know, the Guardians always have a decent amount of noteworthy hitting prospects, and sometimes they don't produce quite as much as you expect there. Let's move on to High A. So we got 12 Midwest League teams, 12 Sally League teams, and then 9 teams in the six teams in the Northwest League. So that's kind of an interesting league, the smallest of the full season leagues in the Northwest there. How do the three High A leagues compare from a run scoring standpoint?
The Midwest League has a well-earned reputation for being pitcher friendly. You know, it's the combination of the weather and the parks, it tends to play in favor of pitchers. And in fact, in the last 2 years, it has seen the fewest runs scored of any league. So a very good place for organizations to send pitchers who are just starting out. And a tough assignment, especially back in the old days when it was low A, it was a tough place to send your high school kids from, you know, from the South or those from Latin America. Let's see. So in terms of at this level, at high A, South Atlantic League tends to be, have the most hitter friendly parks. And what we see there is Asheville and Greensboro are two notorious home run parks in the Sally League, as is Hickory. And so I would say most offensive tends to be in the Sally League, particularly the South. The North that has, you know, Brooklyn and Aberdeen and Jersey Shore and Wilmington, those are much more pitcher friendly. It's one of those leagues that's kind of bunched together awkwardly. So really just the South of the Sally League, the traditional Sally League, and then the Midwest tends to favor pitchers.
Yeah, the you know, Asheville has always been a, I almost think Asheville is responsible for more false positives on the hitting side for prospects than maybe any other park, just because I think people know to kind of adjust for it with the PCL. But over the years, the Rockies and then the Astros, like, they've sent a lot of these, you know, 22-year-old college guys, 23-year-old college guys even, to Asheville, and they just put up monster numbers. And then people say, oh, well, this Rockies prospect or this Astros prospect is breaking out at high A. But you definitely got to remember, Asheville is, like you said, it's just a great place to hit homers. And
especially to right field, I believe it's got a very short right field fence at Asheville.
Yes. Yeah, very good to keep in mind. So lefty hitters that put up big numbers at Asheville. I kind of, unless it's a guy that, you know, was that has the pedigree and maybe is age appropriate, you know, like 19, 20 years old, unless it's someone like that I was bullish on before they got to Asheville, it's kind of like I just need to see do it at double A almost before fully buying in. So which, we should discuss the very bottom high A team, the team that its affiliate just jumps all of its hitting prospects over, the Tri-City Dust Devils of the Northwest League.
Yep.
that is the toughest park in all of full season ball to score runs in.
Yeah. Now that you mention it, it is. that is amazing. That's Angels affiliate, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I wonder if that's, I'm going to pull up the Tri-City roster and just look at
what's funny about the Northwest League in general is it's six teams. Like, does that really constitute a league? I don't think so. But and the facilities are among the oldest in the minor leagues. So it's a strange combination of like not having enough viable locations to field the league and having not enough, you know, venues up to standard. It's really an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, do you think it's going to be in existence 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
The Northwest and the Cal, you know, because to meet the facility standards that Major League Baseball has set, those two leagues in particular have the most uphill climb to meet the standards. So if you were going to pick two, I would start with the Northwest, yeah.
So I'm looking at the Tri-City roster for hitters. You know, it's like Denzer Guzman is probably the guy with the most pedigree there. Werner Blakely, Alexander Ramirez. Like, it's definitely not, there are no real notable dynasty prospects on that Tri-City roster. And I wonder if the scoring was as low as it has been over these past 2 years before the Angels decided to just jump all their good hitters over that level. I'm not sure.
That's a great question. Or just draft collegians and then rush them to the major leagues.
Right. And then Brooklyn was the second lowest run scoring park at High A. And Sam Dykstra mentioned on the pod a couple weeks ago just about how the stadium is located. You just have the wind blowing into left field and kind of keeping balls in the park in that direction. So
it keep that in mind when you evaluate Ryan Clifford, who went from Asheville to Brooklyn with that Justin Verlander trade. So he goes from the best hitting park at the venue to one of the worst.
Yeah, definitely. I'd love to see a game in Brooklyn, but wouldn't necessarily want to send my top lefty sluggers to Brooklyn. Okay, let's talk about single A. So we've got 12 Carolina League teams, 10 Florida State League teams, and 8 Cal League teams. You know, I think these leagues have kind of clear, you know, things that are always sort of true with the run scoring. How would you compare those three leagues?
Yeah, Cal League, notoriously hitter friendly, second most friendly for runs scored over the past couple seasons. And that's true as far back as you go. It's always PCL, Cal. The old Pioneer League would be up here too. But yeah, you're going to see more runs there. So teams are probably not sending their best pitchers there or not sending them there for long. Take hitting stats with a grain of salt for Cal League affiliates. You know, but again, apply the Corbin Carroll rule. If they're truly elite talents, don't ding them too much. And then the Florida State is one of the best pitchers leagues for many reasons. The size of the parks, they tend to be huge, and the ball doesn't carry. Carolina League kind of in the middle of those two extremes overall.
Yeah, do you think I tend to look at, I don't know about you, but like when you're looking at like a Florida State League pitcher, I don't generally downgrade them too much in my head if they're having success there, even though it is a pitcher friendly league, because I'm mostly looking at walks and strikeouts anyways. Is that kind of how you look at it? Or
I tend to really only scrutinize the park factor if they're playing in an extreme hitter environment,
right? Yeah, so we've got the Down East Wood Ducks bringing up the rear here.
I believe that's their last year before they relocate too. So,
do you know where they're? Where they're
going? I believe they're going to Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Okay, so that's the Rangers single A affiliate. Lowest runs per game at single A. There's a few. You get Brooklyn, Tri-City, Mississippi are even more pitcher-friendly, but Down East is kind of one of the more pitcher-friendly parks in the minors. And then Fayetteville, Jupiter, Myrtle Beach. Yeah, I'm looking at like the bottom for low A, and it's basically just a bunch of Florida State League teams mixed in with a handful of Carolina League teams. But the Cal League definitely dominates there. Which of the Cal League parks are specifically damaging for pitchers and advantageous for hitters?
What's fascinating about the Cal League is that over the course of time, the league has shed some of the biggest outliers: High Desert, Lancaster, Bakersfield. Lost all those, but it still remains extremely hitter friendly. Let's see. So if we look at, just in terms of total runs scored, Stockton is tops at OA. Rancho Cucamonga, Lake Elsinore, Visalia, those are your leaders, and in the Empire not far behind. So it's no matter where you turn, you're going to be a pretty hitter friendly environment. I think Modesto is the only one that's a little more neutral.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about Lancaster and High Desert in a while, but yeah, that brings back some memories of
like Bakersfield was like 350 or something to center field. It was very small outfield dimension.
Yeah, we still got to adjust, but we don't have to quite adjust as dramatically as we used to with the Cal League. And then, you know, we're not going to break down any of the specific rookie league venues, but fair to just assume that every rookie league environment is skewed towards the hitter.
I would say so. I think, you know, batted balls tend to fall for hits more often. There's more errors, more wild pitches. Everything tends to favor offense at that level. You know, as you go down further, even in amateur ball, the same philosophy would apply.
Yeah.
And the thing, what's notable about rookie ball in particular is that the hitters are getting younger and the pitchers are getting slightly older. It's kind of weird. And I think this feeds into the team's preference for college pitchers because they have to get more innings out of the pro pitchers now that they can carry fewer domestic minor league players. So I think that's only going to get wider, just more and more college pitchers, whereas teams have great track records drafting high school and signing 17-year-old Latin players. So I think that will continue.
Yeah. It really kind of sucks developmentally that we don't have the short season leagues anymore. Just because there is that type of player that you want to give a bit more of a challenge to than complex league, but not quite ready for full season. So
that player now goes to like low A for the first half. That's pretty much what that league, that level has become. It's kind of like the new New York Penn League, especially in the first half.
Yeah. Did you have any reaction to like Sebastian Walcott specifically getting jumped over single A this year? And now he's just kind of falling flat on his face at high A predictably. But did you like what, I don't know if you thought of anything when you saw that assignment for Walcott, because I, you know, Ethan Salas getting assigned to high A wasn't surprising, but Walcott, you know, I think single A even might have been like, I would have been like hoping that he kept his head above water at single A.
Yeah, that is interesting. And they signed him to Hickory last year too. Huh. No, I hadn't really noticed that.
Yeah. Okay. So I was pulling up a piece from your colleague JJ Cooper, just looking at some rule stuff for this year that could also affect the scoring. Obviously mentioned the pre-tack ball in the Southern League last year in the first half. You know, you had strikeout rates way up for hitters and pitchers. And then the bigger issue in all the minors last year was just the automated balls and strikes at AAA and how that kind of inflated walk rates. Now there is still automated balls and strikes this year at AAA and in all the Florida State League parks except Daytona. But I thought it was notable that the zone in the high A parks is going to be, I think, 3 inches wider. Yeah, three inches wider in the Florida State League, I think, just because the pitchers don't have good enough command for it to be the same zone as the AAA zone. And then they increased the strike zone by 2.5% at AAA because last year it seemed like the walk rates were spiked kind of in a way they weren't intending. So they're trying to cut that down. And then they have a system where on the weekend they're not using ABS, but pitchers can challenge strike calls as long as they get the challenge in within 2 seconds. They only get three incorrect challenges per game. I think I summed that all up. Anything else we want to mention in terms of just like rules this year, or anything you wanted to talk about in terms of the ABS system?
Yeah, modifying that ABS zone in AAA was essential because you would hear organizations talk about how pitchers couldn't buy a called strike at the top of the zone. It was too restrictive at the upper three boxes of the 3x3 grid.
Yeah. And that was what, you know, part of like Jared Jones, what he did last year at AAA, what made it so impressive was just that he had kind of a normal walk rate there while all these other pitchers were really struggling. And he was one of the youngest pitchers at that level. And then did you want to talk about the kind of the moving the rookie league schedule up and how you sort of see that affecting the dynasty game?
Yeah. This season, for the first time ever, Arizona and Florida complex rookie leagues are starting on May 4th. So it's like a full month earlier than usual. So I think it's, you kind of have to recalibrate the way you think about some of the, especially the DSL class of last year. You have to think about how these players are going to have relevant data sooner, and you're probably going to have to react and respond sooner. So keep that in mind as you're looking at those early results from that league. You might need to make decisions sooner.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I'm really excited by this. Like I just, it's always a tough couple of months to wait for those leagues to open up. So it's going to be really exciting, but it's also going to make that, like I do my first in-season update and like kind of around Memorial Day, it's going to make that update more challenging because you're going to have all these rookie guys with, you know, 12 games worth of data or whatever. So that'll be challenging.
And on the back end, there's no, because the league ends, the season ends right around the time of the draft. So the players who sign out of the 24 draft, you know, they're not going to have a formal rookie league to be assigned to.
Yeah, I mean, I think the backfield games at the complexes are going to be maybe better than ever. Just, you know, when you get into kind of like late July, early August, and you've got just guys kind of with nowhere to play necessarily. That doesn't necessarily affect me too much, but anyone who's able to check out those games, I'd recommend trying to if you can. All right. So I think that kind of covers our park factor and rule discussion. Again, these are things you absolutely got to be considering if you're kind of doing your at home prospect rankings or you're looking for breakout candidates. Definitely good to keep in mind where they're playing, especially for the guys in these very favorable hitting environments. And then also, kind of like Matt mentioned with the Midwest League, just be patient with some of the players who might be playing in very cold conditions this time of year. That was a good point. I hadn't actually really thought about that. I do like that the Midwest League is no longer the first full season league that these guys are getting sent to. So hopefully they maybe have a bit more experience with colder weather at that point. Matt, before we talk about your Devils Rejects rebuild, which I think you've done a fantastic job with since joining that league, you're kind of the guy, you're the first guy I think of when Cubs shortstop prospect Jefferson Rojas comes across my timeline or I'm checking out what he's doing because you were kind of banging that drum for most of last year. Rojas is off to a excellent start at high, I believe. He's very young, which I'm sure you might mention. He still is 18, turns 19 in about a week, and he is hitting 325, 357, 525 with a couple homers, which is notable since he hit 7 in 70 games last year. And
in the Midwest League too. Sorry.
Right. Yeah. So we just talked about the Midwest League. Here's an 18-year-old shortstop with a 154 WRC plus. So talk to me about Rojas and just kind of what you saw last year, maybe what you had in terms of expectations for this year and where you sort of see his game going.
Yeah, Rojas kind of snuck up on the Cubs a little bit. They weren't expecting him to be a full season player last year necessarily. They started him in the ACL after one game, I believe they promoted him. A very strong indicator right there of the player's physical, mental maturity, his tools, his ability to adapt. And the reports we were getting on him were pretty solid scouting reports, not like future star or anything. I think that's the thing you'd be concerned about with Rojas. It might not necessarily be a future plus. We might be looking at like Luis Garcia or for old timers, someone like Carlos Schoenfeld, where the age is like the dominating metric you're looking at and focusing on. But you know, to me, it's a good a player who's mentally and physically mature and has shown signs of hitting is a good gamble, and who plays shortstop and is doing it in pitchers leagues. I think it's a compounding effect of why I'm as bullish as I am.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think the two home runs so far is very encouraging for him. And the reports I've seen, it sounds like he can maybe stick at shortstop, which I think at least the fact that he at least projects to offer some defensive value, maybe even if he can't stick at shortstop, I think that's notable. You know, not a burner necessarily, but I guess, you know, when he's that young, you don't want to necessarily cap what he could do on the bases. But, you know, I would maybe throw out like Adele Amador as like kind of like a good version of where this could go, although Amador walks a bit more than Rojas, mm-hmm. although kind of hard to hold that against him when he's still 18 at high A.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think, yeah, and you know, Luis Garcia is showing stuff early on for the Nationals, so maybe there's hope.
I wonder what percentage of dynasty rosters that were rostering the prospect version of Luis Garcia still had him on their teams. This has been the ultimate test of patience, I would say. To keep going back to that well, and probably for the Nationals as well. Okay, Matt, so as I said, you and I both play in the Devils Rejects League, and we're always chatting about pickups and draft picks made in that league. So when did you take over this orphan roster? And are there any players left from when you took it over?
Yeah, I took it over after 2020. The team, as I understand it, finished 20th out of 20. So not particularly loaded, but it did have a few gems on the roster. It had Bobby Witt Jr. It's a great place to start. Had CJ Abrams, had Shane McClanahan. I think that might be it. And none of those players was established in the major leagues. I don't think any of them had. McClanahan had pitched in the postseason in 2020. That was the extent of their major league experience. So those guys were keepers, not that there was that many alternatives. So that's kind of where it started. My first trade, I traded Hunter Green for Gunnar Henderson. So that one, because this roster, in addition to having those players, was constructed oddly, I would say. It had a ton of pitching prospects. From memory, it had Gore, Jesus Luzardo, Sixto Sanchez, Nate Pearson, Hunter Green, Matt Manning, Luis Patino.
Wow.
So it was a bad performing team with a farm system focused on pitchers. So it was kind of an awkward start.
That's a fun list of like young pitchers that you could have on a dynasty roster like a few years ago, and just sort of seeing like the hit rate there and the bust rate. Seems about right, honestly. Yeah, you end up with like two good arms, like two total busts, like a few guys where like injuries came into play. So what you mentioned, the Hunter Green for Gunnar trade, obviously that's a hell of a trade. You've got a fantastic core of young hitters: Bobby Witt, Gunnar, Ellie, O'Neill Cruz, Adolis Garcia, Vinny P, Andres Jimenez. So you got a bunch of middle infielders. So that's, I'm sure that's the big strength here. But do you have any kind of other moves that you always kind of think about in terms of the build here, and maybe any kind of piece of advice that you'd give someone taking over an orphan roster like this?
Yeah, in a roundabout way, we've touched on two of them. I look for shortstops who perform in the minor leagues. I think there's, in addition to filling a valuable major league niche, if they reach the majors at that position, they also tend to be the best athletes. They tend to be the most adaptable to be able to make changes in position, changes in hitting approach, et cetera. I think shortstops tend to be the ones who show more growth than other positions, and don't overvalue pitching prospects. Because not only are they volatile, but on the waiver wire, a big portion of the breakouts are going to be pitchers, major league pitchers anyway. So I wouldn't overinvest in pitchers.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's 100% true. That's all. It's pretty textbook there. Yeah, you've got, so like you're pitching, you're third in the league. It's very, very early. But you've got, I guess, like Logan Gilbert, Shane McClanahan, obviously you're waiting to get healthy. You had Jeffrey Springs, your Framber Valdez. So you're waiting on some injured guys. And then you picked up Aaron Civale, Zach Little along the way. So yeah, I think going after those, you know, you want to have some tools. Like you don't want it to just be a bunch of Brian Rocchios, but yeah, I mean, going after guys that are going to add defensive value is something that I've always tried to do in Dynasty, especially like a Dynasty startup, something like that, because you don't want to end up with a bunch of guys who can only play util or can only play outfield on like a platoon basis or something like that.
Yeah, and then for me, I don't know if everybody abides by this, but I don't ignore major league value, even with a bad team, because, you know, contenders will always trade you good prospects for the good veterans. I got Bobby Miller that way. I got Miguel Vargas that way, and he hasn't shown much in the majors yet, but there's still hope. and then, you know, the contending teams tend to be better managers, so they tend to have better inventory in the first place. So I would keep that in mind in a rebuild.
Yeah, definitely. How like active of a trader would you say you are in this league?
Oh, probably around average. Try to make a few trades a year, but not by strength, I would say.
Sure. Yeah. Well, this is a great roster. It's a 20 team OBP league. And it's always I think this is a tough league to do a full rebuild in like you did as well, because it doesn't necessarily lend itself to just going, oh, I'm just going to keep these like 30 prospects and then hope that like 10 of them hit and then I'll be okay. Like there's only 28 keepers per year in this league. So it's a challenging league to go from orphan to contender in. And, you know, I think you've done that. So great job. Is there you had any other thoughts on DR or any BA stuff you want to plug before we wrap it up?
No, I would say, you know, subscribe to Baseball America as you subscribe to RotoWire, and you can find me at Matt Eddie BA on Twitter, on X Twitter.
Awesome, Matt. Well, thank you so much for coming on the pod, and thank you so much for all the invaluable stuff you put out on Minor League Park Factors over the years. Really appreciated it. Thank you.
Thank you, James. My pleasure.